Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have the prospects for Americans who wish to marry someone of the same sex changed so rapidly in the past several years? On the same night in November 2008 that Americans elected Barack Obama president, the state of California also passed an initiative known as Proposition 8, a state constitutional amendment that made it illegal for same-sex couples to marry. The passage of Prop 8 came as a serious blow to marriage equality advocates, but as my guest today will tell us, it also catalyzed a powerful counter-effect that brought some activists together across party lines and helped chart the course for efforts in numerous other states to give same-sex couples the legal right to wed if they wanted to. Joe Becker is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Her new book is called Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality. Joe, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did Proposition 8 come about in California in the first place?
Right. Well, what happened was that the California Supreme Court found in the state constitution a right for gays and lesbians to marry. And 18,000 people went and got married, and but within months, they had the people who were opposed to same-sex marriage had put a ballot initiative on the ballot to change the Constitution so that it no longer contained the right that the court found that it had, and that is what Proposition 8 did, and what the courts ended up finding was that the 18,000 people who had gotten married, their marriages remained valid, but no further marriages could occur.
After that, how unified were LGBT activists in California on the subject of how, when, and even whether to challenge the amendment?
Right. Not at all unified. This was a really controversial step. What happened was, this is a really interesting group of characters here, a guy named Chad Griffin, he was an outsider, not an LGBT activist. He was a political consultant. And, you know, he went to lunch with some friends. Those friends happened to be kind of powerful and they had a lot of money. They were the Reiners, Rob Reiner, one of Hollywood's top donors and the director of movies like When Harry Met Sally. So they were commiserating with Chad and thinking, you know, I mean, if they couldn't win at the ballot box in California, you know, where could they win? This is the left coast and they had passed this. And so what happened was at that lunch, this kind of really one of many kind of kismet or serendipitous moments happened, which a friend of the Reiners happened to wander over, heard what they were talking about, and fast forward said, you know, you really ought to call my ex-brother-in-law. He's a constitutional lawyer, and I think he'd be with you on this. And they said, well, who is that? And they said, Ted Olson. And everybody's jaw just dropped because, of course, Ted Olson is a man that liberals love to hate because he won Bush v. Gore for Bush.
Right. And remind us, because he was in Bush v. Gore and he was arguing for the man who did, in fact, become president against another attorney named David Boies.
Yes. And so Ted Olson got enlisted. So what happened was Rob Reiner and Chad Griffin at the table thought, well, this sounds crazy. But if a guy like Ted Olson, someone as conservative as he is, could embrace marriage equality and fight for this cause, that had the potential in their mind to be a game changer, because it would really recast what had been viewed largely through sort of a political lens as a partisan fight to a bipartisan sort of civil rights battle. And so they did approach him, and they knew that that Olson's involvement would cause a lot of upset in the LGBT community, and it would be greeted with great suspicion. And in fact, it was. People thought, well, did he take the case to tank it? And so they knew that they had to get someone from across the aisle. And after several other lawyers who were actually involved in the cause turned them down because they felt that, you know, what they were doing was quite risky, going to the Supreme Court with this. David Boies said yes. He and Olson had become friends, actually, after Bush v. Gore.
Meanwhile, Ted Olson was initially approached by backers of Prop 8 to defend it in the courts.
Yeah, that's right. Initially, that's true. They had, and he said, "I want no part of this." And you know, it's sort of interesting because Olson has an interesting background on this issue. He is quite conservative. You know, this is probably the only issue that liberals agree with him on. But he had said as early back as 2000, he was at a dinner I describe in the book, and he talks about how, you know, this was coming and that it was just not right to deny this as a matter of rights. And he was telling people at dinner, you know, you accept this because it's going to happen in your lifetime. And even before that, he, in private conversations in the White House, in the Bush White House, when they were talking about supporting a federal constitution to define marriages between a man and a woman, which, by the way, never happened, but they were talking about it. You know, he said, "What are you thinking, trying to put something like this in the Constitution?" So he actually had a long record.
Now, the other case, of course, that was important last year was the Defense of Marriage Act, which actually was signed by President Bill Clinton. Can you remind us of why that legislation was so important and so powerful?
Sure. Back in the Clinton era, the Defense of Marriage Act defined marriage as between a man and a woman for the purpose of doling out federal benefits. So that is the provision that Edie Windsor, who was widowed, and she got this whopping tax bill when she inherited her legal wife's estate, she had to pay taxes on that. If Edie's spouse had been a man, that would never have happened. And she got very angry, and you know, she went and tried to get some people in the you know, the sort of established rights groups, the LGBT rights groups, to take her case. And they told her no. I mean, you have to kind of cast back a little bit. When this book starts 5 years ago, and the book is really about the litigation effort, there were only two states with that allowed same-sex couples to marry. I mean, today it's 17, but mm-hmm. there were only two, and the majority of the country was opposed to this. And so what the people who had been working on these issues for quite some time had put a lot of thought into this, and they felt, you know, the country wasn't ready and the court wouldn't be ready. It wasn't that they didn't share the goal, that they didn't think that bans like Prop 8 were unconstitutional, or that they didn't think that DOMA was unconstitutional. It was a fear of going to the federal courts at a time when they were worried that could lead to a setback. The courts weren't ready. And it kind of echoes in a way, you know, I think this happens in every civil rights movement. You know, there was back in the previous centuries fights, you know, there were people in the African-American community that thought, you know, you're moving too fast. You're pushing for too much. You're asking too much. And then there were people who said, no, we have to move faster. You know, when, you know, you can't wait for justice. You have to demand it. And so there's a thread of that runs all the way through the book.
So how did Olson and Boies begin to structure their argument against Proposition 8? And who were the plaintiffs that they represented?
Yeah, so what's interesting is, because most people think, and in Edie Windsor's case this was true, you know, a few people sort of get upset about something and they try to find a lawyer and they go to the court. And in this case, you know, the lawyers came first. And so they got to kind of shape, well, what kind of plaintiffs would we want? And I describe in the book about, you know, Ted Olson had some very specific criteria. He wanted a bookstore owner, a police officer, and I think it was a teacher. Anyhow, the point being, he wanted regular people. He did not want activists. He did not want political officials. He wanted regular people because, you know, he wanted people that the justices that America would relate to.
And how was this couple? What made this couple so particularly relatable?
Well, there were two couples, actually. And Jeff and Paul are from the Los Angeles area, and Chris and Sandy are from Berkeley, California. And, you know, their story is just so compelling. You know, when you sort of I started writing, as I said, I decided to do this book about 5 years ago, and I got to follow them all the way through this, ups and downs. I drove to court with them. I was with them, you know, the first day when they stepped out of the car, and the first day of the federal court trial where they were, you know, there was protesters all around. Sandy and Chris had four boys total, two that were still living at home, you know, they during this trial, I described the kind of threatening phone calls that they would get in the middle of the night. I mean, this was hard. You know, it was not easy to suddenly be the face of this kind of effort. And I delve into that quite a lot in the book. But the four of them are really, you know, they put themselves out there in a way, you know, this trial, they didn't even realize that there would be a trial. They had thought that this whole thing would be decided on legal motions.
We're speaking this hour with Jo Becker. She's an investigative reporter for The New York Times, a winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and author of the new book, Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with New York Times investigative reporter Jo Becker. Her new book is called Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet @ChrisBoydThink. Okay, Jo, so if you have a team that is working to possibly take down Proposition 8, of course you have to have a legal team as well in defense of Proposition 8. Talk about how that team came together.
Sure. Well, what's interesting about this is that the state of California decided not to defend this initiative that the voters had passed. And you're seeing that now all across the country. A lot of attorneys general are saying that they will not defend bans that are now similar bans that are now under constitutional attack because they just don't think that they are constitutional. But Governor Schwarzenegger and then Attorney General Jerry Brown made that decision. They were the first officials to make that decision, and they said that they wouldn't defend it. And so what happened was the official ballot proponents, the people who had put Prop 8 on the ballot, became the defendants of the case. And they hired an attorney named Charles Cooper. And Cooper is a really well-known attorney in Washington. He takes on quite a lot of conservative causes. He's very well known for fighting affirmative action as on the legal front, and so they asked him to become involved, and you know, it's such a small little world. This book, Charles Cooper was very good friends with Ted Olson, and they had known each other in the Reagan Justice Department, so they were now pitted against each other in this case.
Was Cooper reluctant at all to take the case?
No, not at all. I mean, for Chuck Cooper, this is a matter of states' rights. He didn't really actually think of this. And again, you know, you sort of have to cast back. When he took this case, it wasn't particularly a controversial position to take. The majority of Americans believed that marriage should be between a man and a woman back then. And so when he took the case, he just thought he didn't really see it as much as a kind of a gay rights issue. He saw it more as the people and the legislatures should have the opportunity to decide issues like this. And he also believed he's a strict constructionalist, meaning he believes that the Constitution contains only those rights that are explicitly spelled out. And there's nowhere where it says in the Constitution that, you know, same-sex couples have a right to marry. So he sort of thought it was pretty straightforward. And in fact, he told me, interestingly, that when, you know, that if someone had come to him and said, I want you to defend Vermont's right to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, he would have taken that case too.
Hmm. On the other hand, he did have some, I mean, everybody's life is complex at home, right? But there were some things that made this case particularly complex for him.
It is. It's, you know, the issue is a complex issue, and so many families are trying to kind of sort through it. So when Chuck Cooper first took this case, you know, he told me, you know, he has six kids and not all of them agreed with him on this issue. And during the trial, you know, he was so moved by the testimony of the plaintiffs. It's so interesting because they were so scared to testify. They really didn't anticipate, you know, having a full-blown trial where they have to get on the stand and potentially be cross-examined. And so their fear was only – their only thought about Chuck Cooper was, you know, that fear of him. And they had no way of knowing that actually – you know, they were trying to speak to an audience with this, with their testimony, not just the court, but also the American public, to try to explain what it really feels like to want something so badly, to want to be able to marry. It's something that everybody else has, and but be told, no, you can't have that. Your relationship is different. You can't have that. And so they were testifying about this, and Chris Perry, one of the plaintiffs, was talking about how, you know, if bands like Proposition 8 hadn't existed, that her entire life would have been lived on a higher arc. And that if kids in Bakersfield, California, where she, you know, grew up, could live in a world where these kinds of bands, you know, didn't exist, that she assumes that they would just have, you know, all of these greater kind of expectations for their life and live a just a happier and fuller life. And unbeknownst, I mean, everybody, her kids were crying. Her mother was in the courtroom and crying. But the thing that they could have never imagined is how touching this testimony was to Chuck Cooper, who told me, and I describe in the book about, you know, how he felt listening to this. It was, you know, it reminded him, he said, of what an excruciatingly difficult political issue this was. And that it also made him feel that, you know, people like Chris and Sandy, that they their position is a legitimate one and a deserving of respect. Not that he, you know, he still legally, you know, fought the good fight, but on a political level, his view was obviously much more nuanced than his client's. So fast forward, he didn't know anything about his family at this point, but about midway through the case, he found out that one of his six kids, his stepdaughter Ashley, who he's very close with, is a lesbian. And what's fascinating is, and you'll read about, if you read the book, you'll read about this trial and all the testimonies. You know, everything went on trial in this trial. It was, you know, the history of marriage, the science of sexuality, what makes a good parent, all of these things. But he told me that listening to that trial, being a part of that trial, his daughter told me, Ashley told me, she thinks it made him a better parent when she came out. I mean, isn't that fascinating? And I think, look, I think one of the really important points about this debate is there's, and my book, is there are no good guys and bad guys in my book. And that was a very deliberate, you know, decision. It was, America has evolved on this issue. Movement means movement. People used to think something different. And now a quarter of the people who say they support same-sex marriage, they used to believe the other way. So it's a, you know, people, as they learn more about, you know, why gays and lesbians want to get married, when they realize it's for the exact same reason that they do, they just, you know, want to commit to each other. They love each other. It's not some big political statement. And when they come to know people in their own family, as Chuck did, he told me that his daughter is now getting married in Massachusetts to her fiance. And, you know, he's, you know, joyfully taking part in planning the wedding. And in Massachusetts, of course, it's legal to get married. And so, you know, I think what's happening, you know, what this is kind of a microcosm of what's happening all across America, which is, you know, change kind of happens around the kitchen table, Ronald Reagan used to say, right? And when people come to know gay people or realize, as Senator Rob Portman, a Republican senator, mentioned as a potential vice presidential or presidential candidate, has changed his position politically on this issue because his son came out to him. And you start to realize, I want for my gay children what the same thing I want for my straight children, which is that they find someone, that they fall in love, that they get married, and that they live happily ever after.
It's interesting because all along, in recent years, it seems people who are advocates of marriage equality for gays and lesbians have been careful not to sort of alienate the people who don't yet or don't currently agree with them, in many cases couching their language to allow room for evolution later on.
Yeah, I talk about this in the book. I mean, there's a very deliberate strategy here. Look, nobody wants to be told that they're a bad person for feeling something and taking a position that most people have taken for years and years. And so, you know, you can say, well, this is wrong, this is unconstitutional, you know, or you can say, you know, it's funny, one of the main characters of this book is Ken Melman, who's a former Republican Party chairman, architect of George Bush's reelect. He came out to take part in this case. And, you know, he's this sort of brilliant political strategist. And he talked about how, you know, you don't tell people, you know, say you're a Ford dealer. You don't say, oh, you know, GM is terrible. You know, I can't, how did you ever buy a GM? You say, Ford is so great. Ford is just like GM, but better.
Melman is such a fascinating figure for so many reasons. He also spoke with the Obama White House about how they might craft strategy. Is that right? With regard to this issue?
Yeah. So what happened was he came out. Ken is a fierce partisan. He is a Republican through and through. Mm-hmm. But for this issue, it transcends partisanship. So he's willing to help whoever wants to move in this direction. And what happened was he was asked to he volunteered actually to help round up Republican votes that were necessary to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the policy that prevented gays and lesbians from serving openly in the military. And the president invited him to the White House for lunch afterwards. It was a private lunch. And Ken used the opportunity to say, you know, I don't think that endorsing marriage equality is going to kill you. I actually think it's going to help you because it's going to remind people of the attributes that they elected you for, which is this kind of guy that's willing to, you know, just do what's right. Ken believes that people don't vote on issues. They vote on character, and that this would remind people of who Obama really was. And, you know, the president listened. But, you know, it was seemed like they were not going to do this before the election. In fact, the first lady told Chad Griffin, one of the main character of my book, that you know, we'll be with you after the election. But what happened was there was some countervailing forces going on. They had polling that they were concerned that, you know, this would hurt, endorsing marriage equality would hurt them with white Catholic voters, Latino voters, and African-American voters, that it would depress turnout. On the other hand, they started to see polling that said failure to endorse marriage equality was hurting them in turning out 18 to 30-year-olds in the numbers that they needed. This is a touchstone issue for 18 to 30-year-old voters. And so they kind of struggled. They didn't know what to do. It went on for months and months. But in that time, they reached out to Ken, and Ken produced this memo. And it was typical, you know, Ken Melman, you know, is point by point, the bullet points, how you can talk about this issue in a way that resonates with people who are on the fence. And among the many things that he advised was that the president, if he were going to endorse this, should sit down with a woman, should talk about how his own kids, you know, don't sort of get this issue, that it is even an issue.
A woman journalist, excuse me for interrupting you, sit down and tell his story to a woman, a female journalist.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. And that he talk about this in terms of, you know, basic American values of equality, that he talk about it in terms of, you know, the golden rule, do unto others, which Americans, you know, who might be struggling with this as a religious matter could relate to. He talked about it also in terms of talking about it in what he called everyday heroes terms, meaning what you say is, you know, are we really going to tell the service members who are, a serviceman who is serving in Afghanistan, fighting for their country, for instance, that he can't marry the man he loves? And that he talk about it in terms of, like, government intrusion. A lot of Americans don't like the government in their life. And so to say things like, is the government really, you know, should they be determining this? And so, you know, that memo is sort of, we discuss that in the book, and it's quite striking, you know, that Obama did hit many of those points when he finally did endorse.
My guest is New York Times investigative reporter Jo Becker. Her new book is called Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in about 2 minutes with Jo Becker.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with New York Times investigative journalist Joe Becker, author of the new book, Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Joe, to what extent have President Obama's personal views evolved, and to what extent have his public admissions of his personal views evolved?
Well, I think his public statements have evolved. Mm-hmm. He was for marriage equality before he was against it, before he was evolving, and then before he was for it. Mm-hmm. So, as a young state Senate candidate from the liberal enclave of Illinois' Hyde Park, Chicago, he said he filled out a questionnaire and he said he was for it. Then, as he ran for offices where the electorate was sort of broader and the need to appeal to a kind of broader and more diverse audience was necessary, his position morphed. And you know, I think that this isn't sort of a gotcha kind of thing. I mean, I really think that this is evidence, really, that how difficult it was for gays and lesbians to kind of fight their battles in the political realm, because people, even Democrats, were thought this was just a toxic issue. And I think Bill Clinton's top advisor also told me, and it's in the book, that he never wanted to sign the Defense of Marriage Act, and that he didn't believe that marriage should be between a man and a woman, as he said at the time when he signed it. But, he just felt politically he was getting clobbered and he had to do it. And so, I think that this notion, I mean, in a way, politicians are a lagging indicator. If you want to change, they're kind of like businesses. Like if you want Detroit to buy small cars, well, make their customers want small cars. And it's kind of the same thing. If you want politicians to move on an issue, you need to kind of create the political space for them to do it and for it to be safe for them. And, so I think that, David Axelrod told me, the president's top aide told me, Obama was never comfortable opposing same-sex marriage. And that, he said the politics of authenticity. And not just the politics, he said, but the president's own personal sense of authenticity, demanded that he do what he did eventually, which was to come out and say that he believes that gays and lesbians ought to be able to marry.
All right, let's talk about Vice President Biden, who sort of threw this issue out there perhaps earlier than anyone in the White House had expected it to happen.
Yeah, so everybody remembers probably, or your listeners probably do, Vice President Biden was on Meet the Press, and he was asked this question by David Gregory, and he answered it, and he basically endorsed marriage equality and getting out ahead of the president. So you have to kind of back up to really understand that one of the great stories that I tell in the book is exactly how that happened, and what an accident in history it kind of was. So 2 weeks earlier, he had been at this very small, very private event at the home of HBO executive Michael Lombardo and his husband. And the vice president had come in. He was in the home of, two gay men with their children, who pressed a note and flowers into his hands. And, he was outside playing with them. And so Chad Griffin, who is now the head of the Human Rights Campaign, but at the time was the incoming president, he figured, I'm going to have one question. Why waste it on, where's the administration on marriage equality? The first lady had already told him that, hang with us and we'll be with you after the election. He had pretty much resigned himself to that. But watching the vice president play with these kids, he thought, I'm going to make this personal. He has to answer to them. And so he asked the question. And it was clear that the vice president was very uncomfortable. He kind of flipped his chair around so that the back was between him and the audience. But he started talking, and he said, you know, my kids can't really understand why this is an issue. And he once started, he sort of couldn't seem to stop himself. And he said, you know, my job is to keep this rolling to the inevitable. And everybody kind of looked at each other like, what did he just, you know? And so what happened, you know, and one of his aides said, you know, it was like his hard drive had been erased. He'd been answering that question the same way as the president over and over. But being in that house, something happened. So fast forward 2 weeks later, he's on Meet the Press and he's asked this question. And in, you know, I describe in the book, the vice president told me that, you know, that event in Los Angeles and the question that he'd been asked, he said it was the most poignant question one of the most poignant he'd ever been asked in his life, was sort of still all fresh in his head. And he just couldn't kind of go back to answering it the same old way. So he basically told David Gregory what he'd said in private at this other event, except that this time it was on, you know, Meet the Press. And it was a pre-tape. So it was on Meet the Press, and, you know, which was about to be broadcast to the election. And so when the transcript hit the White House in advance of the airing of the show, chaos erupted.
There were people who speculated that the vice president was sent to do this, and it was sort of a way of floating a weather balloon to see how the American people would react. That is not what you learned to be true.
No, not at all. I mean, people were angry. Valerie Jarrett, the president's top aide, you know, accused him, Biden, of outright disloyalty. Some people sort of behind the scenes were saying, you know, he'd launched his 2016 campaign at the president's expense. One of the really interesting things was that, you know, all of them were urging Obama to take Biden to the woodshed. And, you know, David Axelrod told me he wouldn't do it. You know, he admired Biden for what Axelrod called his exuberant honesty. And despite the fact that this did force the president's hand, I mean, they had been debating this, but it was not at all resolved. The first lady saw it actually as a blessing in disguise, because the endless kind of internal do we or don't we before the election debate was over. And, you know, and he could stop dancing around this as he had been, saying he was evolving and grappling and blah, 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 and speak from his heart. And so she told him that morning, I report in the book, over breakfast before he left for the day for his interview, she said, enjoy this day. You are free.
So, of course, we know that President Obama won re-election. Is there evidence that everything that happened before the 2012 election affected people who did or did not vote to re-elect Barack Obama?
What was really interesting, Dan Pfeiffer, who works, you know, another top aide for the president, said, you know, it was the bomb that didn't go off, meaning they were so worried, you know, that this would hurt the president with key constituencies. And in fact, it did not. It did not hurt him with African Americans. The Catholic voters that they had worried about, the exit polls showed that they supported same-sex marriage. Same thing with Latinos. You know, they had worried that this would hurt him with Latinos, and yet the exit polls showed they actually supported it. And it motivated the president's base, and it did not motivate, as Ken Mellman, you know, the Republican former Republican Party chair, had told Obama, it did not motivate Mitt Romney's base. This was just not a burning issue for Republicans. But the president's progressive base, it was really important. And 18 to 30-year-olds did turn out in force for the president. As I said, it was a touchstone issue for them. It motivated them. You know, it's amazing. They turned out in the same numbers as they had 4 years earlier, even though many of them are struggling in this economy to get a job. So it was a net positive.
What do people fighting for marriage equality expect the next couple of years to bring?
Well, there are, you know, over 60 cases all across this country barreling in state courts and barreling towards the U.S. Supreme Court. I think that it's possible that, you know, it's possible that this could be back before the Supreme Court in the fall. And, you know, as your listeners probably realize, the way that the Supreme Court decided the case that's at the heart of my book, Proposition 8, was it was sort of technical. And so what happened was marriages could resume in California, which was a huge big deal. I mean, that's one-fifth of the country. But they left for another day whether all bans like Prop 8 are unconstitutional. So that's the question that's just barreling right back towards them. If you want to understand the legal issues, I really try to do that in an engaging way in the book. I mean, you sort of, it's not a dry legal treatise. It's about real humans and how they feel being these kind of, you know, plaintiffs in this massive civil rights case, but there are many, many issues that the court is going to have to resolve. And I think, you know, they had hoped in doing this kind of half, the way that deciding that the case is the way that they did, that they were buying some time, but I don't think they bought a lot.
Jo Becker is an investigative reporter for The New York Times and a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize. Her new book is called Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality. Jo, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening today. We are really thrilled to have you with us when we do the program.